Welcome to Tech Breakfast. Today's top headline served hot by your host Aaron Bewley and Tyler Gates. So grab your coffee and let's get into it.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 12th. Today on the show, we have Paul Brehren back for another visit. He is a Dell EMC advisory engineer and the proprietor of Tinkertry.com, as well as an avid technologist. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you so much. What a way to start a Monday morning. This is fun.
Starting strong. I don't have enough coffee in my veins yet, I don't think.
No, it was pretty good.
Good snuggles from my kids, and that just slowed everything down for all the right reasons.
Yeah, I've got my daughter just yelling at me constantly as you're doing the intro, so that's my jolt of coffee in the morning.
Bring her on the show. Bring her on the show. No. Okay, so before we jump right into the news, there were some interesting things historically. On October 12th that we uncovered, I found out that Steve Jobs introduced the Next computer with Steve Wozniak. I guess it was Steve's company Wozniak's company that Jobs
I was about to say, I was like,
Apple.
Wait a minute.
I was like, wait, that's confusing, yeah. And it was ahead of its time, which I think we touch on those topics a lot, but it had some pretty advanced features like optical storage disks and some signal processing that allowed voice recognition. But it had a steep price tag in 1997 of $6,500, which sounds like entirely too many Walkman. I have a feeling that may have contributed to it.
Maybe either one of you know, did that thing ever work? Because I feel like at its demo, I know that it didn't work. I don't know if he ever actually got it completely off the ground before, I guess, Apple maybe reacquired him or something. I don't know if it ever worked. I don't know. Maybe someone on Twitter knows.
Paul, you know that one? Are you familiar with the Next computer and the saga that was that apparently short-lived project?
Yeah, actually, one of my first jobs was in IT at the help desk at Cornell University, and the Cornell had the largest install of Next computers in the entire world. So a little
worked.
A little 90s thing.
A little bit.
Yep,
that's cool.
But that's about
a super fun fact. Yeah.
Were they good?
That is curious.
I didn't get to use one myself, and I heard many years later he was on campus and all that. This is, history was unfolding, but I had no idea. I was just at the help desk.
Oh, that's classic, too. It's right around the corner, somebody's doing something phenomenal. It's like, no, I was just eating at the cafeteria. They were discovering particles at the linear accelerator next door.
Well, we're looking at Mosaic web browser. I remember that day. The very first moment of looking at the browser. Within a month, we had all the students, library card catalog on HTML. Pretty cool. So yeah,
did you recognize how big of a deal that was at the time?
I think we kind of did. Three or four of us standing there. I was doing OS2 stuff and looking over someone's shoulder. Hey, come look at this. And I think we probably all remember that moment.
That's
like
awesome.
Okay, yeah. And you had no firewalls. You were on Ethernet at work. You could just
firewalls
go right
really
to
aren't super that important. I think
go right to the IP address.
Overrated.
It's fine.
Yep.
All right. What do we have today? What do you guys want to jump into?
Oh, gosh. We have a bunch of different things here. I see this Microsoft is bringing the xCloud service to iOS, which originally, I don't know if you guys saw kind of the ups and downs of that. Initially, it was just like, we aren't going to support this because you are not able to individually certify the games that are on this cloud streaming service, this cloud gaming service. And so, Amazon announced theirs. I think we actually talked about that briefly for a little bit, Luna. And they actually support iOS, and everyone was wondering how in the world are they doing that. And they did it with a PWA, so a progressive web app. And it looks like Microsoft, after working with Apple, and I think Google also did the same, where Apple said, it's cool, you can actually do cloud streaming as long as you make an individual app for every single game that is on your streaming service. That would be like asking Netflix
to make an
individual app for every movie. Yeah, that was the request from Apple, was to literally make an individual app for every single one and submit them individually for approval.
Wow.
And obviously, that's a non sequitur. But if you can do it as a progressive web app, just inside of the browser, then it's fine. And that's exactly what Amazon did, and I'm pretty sure Amazon just showed the way. for Microsoft and for Google. And Microsoft's announced it. Google hasn't. I'm assuming Google will do the same in the near future to get it on iOS devices, which has kind of been a big rub. You know, people, tons of people, myself included, I have an iPad. And these services don't work on there. And it's like, that's a perfect platform for something like that to work on. So it's good to see that they're able to get around that using just regular web technologies instead of building an app, which seems like it was going to make a lot of sense when all this first started.
Yeah, that sounds like a kind of huge development overtaking or overcoming of a hurdle there. Is it as big as it sounds technically to have sort of worked their way around that?
Well, if you were on PC, so I will tell you this. This is the first time I've heard of a PWA on a mobile device. I didn't know that that was a thing. I will tell you that I do use progressive web apps on other devices, in particular inside of Linux. So that's a very common way to use an application that doesn't have a native app, but they have a web app, is to turn it into a progressive web app. And it feels a little bit more native. It doesn't feel like you're working inside of a browser necessarily. So I don't know if technically it's a massive accomplishment. I really cannot speak on that, but I can say that this is becoming much more common for multi-platform types of applications that primarily run, you know, over the internet. And so this is really not surprising to see, other than, like I said, the standpoint that they actually are a PWA. What I'm interested in is whether or not you can actually purchase, if you can purchase the games inside of these applications, because if it's not going through the store, then I'm assuming it doesn't have to adhere to any form of, you know, iOS payment policy to purchase the games.
Yes,
and I'm willing to bet that if they get these on there, yeah, exactly. I'm wondering if that's going to maybe spur Apple to be like, you know what, maybe it's cool if you go ahead and just move it into the app store on a single app.
Man, that would actually be really curious too. If they do get around sort of the marketplace rules by doing this, it makes Epic's battle with Apple look pretty silly.
It will definitely come up. For sure.
I lost the notes because I think I just caught this when I was scrolling late at night. But apparently, Epic has given up a ton of users on Fortnite because of this tiff that they kind of started.
Actually, I have that one. 73 million iOS users in order to fight against Apple.
Yeah. I don't even think I read that right, because 73 million sounds bigger today.
And to make it relative, I think they have 300 or 350 million users total across all platforms. So
that's
like a fairly decent
quarter almost. Yeah.
Yep. It's 350. You're right. Business Insider. Yeah.
It's a little less than a quarter, but that's an insane number of users to give up.
It is an absolutely
obviously they see some money in it. And it'll be neat to see how that all unfolds. You got any thoughts on that one, Paul? What do you think about Fortnite and Epic with Apple and all of the just app store, you know, sort of scrutiny that all these big tech companies are going through right now?
Yeah, I think it's a tough road ahead. You definitely can alienate your users who like you. And now if you kind of hurt your brand there, people don't know if they want to demonize Apple or Fortnite, or it's tricky.
I feel like no one likes either one of them right now.
Right.
Well, that's a good way to put it.
you're both jerks. Just make this easy and stop charging us more.
I mean, it is about money. That's how it usually is. So,
oh yeah,
how it'll land, who knows? You could kind of see it coming with all those years with Apple getting that share. But just to say you're a big guy and you can get away with this, and then lawyers maybe saying maybe not. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Well, let's pivot to some of the darker side of tech news real quick, and then we'll probably hit some of the fun stuff.
Darker side of tech news.
I feel every time we have a conversation, we end up talking about vulnerabilities and breaches and stuff like that.
Nope.
And I saw a few stories this morning that I thought would be fun to link together. One was Visa and JP Morgan are already prepping for quantum cyber attacks. And that's that topic for me is super interesting because it came up a lot in the crypto mining space as well, because a lot of crypto coins started making claims about being ASIC resistant, which I believe is pretty common at this point. And that just means dedicated circuits that draw, you know, do gigaflops of calculations and things like that were kind of messing up the way the economy was designed to work. So they started building resistance into that. But then also the idea of immutable blockchain and things like that, cryptographic computers or quantum computers were potentially going to be able to disrupt those blockchains. So they started discussing it pretty actively. This is the first time, at least in a while, that I've seen sort of a prominent financial institution in the news about sort of designing against quantum cryptography, which is just sort of another escalation in that space, right?
Yeah, I've seen this a couple times of, well, that's not true. I've seen this a couple times where there has been the concern. Where people are wondering about, you know, especially as we get closer and closer to doing something functional with quantum computers, the immediate thought is what negative can come of this? And the thought process is, and it's not unfounded. I mean, oftentimes, you know, bad actors are well ahead of us on the ways we leverage technology. It's like, how can we immediately break a system of security? And this has been talked about a lot. I am curious, maybe that one of the two of you know, has it been proven? Like, do we know, has anyone actually been able to break cryptography using, you know, a quantum computer, even in research? I don't know if it's been done yet.
If I'm not mistaken, the answer is yes, but it doesn't, the number of qubits required to break like current publicly key cryptography is not there yet, right? So we've talked about quantum computers a couple of times, and they've got 8/16-bit, I think, is the highest I've seen so far, and 16 might actually be a stretch. But researchers are actually estimating that it'll take a 250 million qubit system to break current publicly cryptography. And so I think there's a way to go there, but the threat is real. Because it just ends up being math.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's good to see that we're trying to get ahead of it. That's for sure.
Yeah, looking here, it looks like by 2023, IBM has their qubit device of 1,000 plus. So not even, you know, we're still a ways out. But yeah, hoovering up all this data and keeping it for the year you can break it open, crypto, that's the concern, right?
Yeah, and actually reading through the article, it's interesting because one of the things it's saying is basically that they're developing processes, if nothing else right now, to identify the data that most critically needs to be protected against these new methods as they become more available, right? So some of this is just saying, all right, it's going to happen eventually. Everything's encrypted today. We have so much data, we can't very well make it all, you know, anti-quantum. So what is our means of protecting the stuff first that's going to keep us, I guess, safer longer sort of stuff?
Sure. So, and Paul, what was that thing about IBM? You said, were they going to have something available by 2023, you were saying? Or
yeah, looking at a roadmap, I should disclose I had the honor of working there for 21 years. And I just looking at the roadmap here on a public website, scaling, they're going to have a product in 2023 is what they're saying here. Wow, I got some pictures and everything. Yeah, some pictures of it.
Yeah, a 1,000 plus qubit device called IBM Quantum Condor targeted for the end of 2023.
But they have one now at 65. It gives you an idea. There's a little scaling chart in
there. Yeah, okay. Yep. So that's, there's me not paying attention to the industry enough. Obviously, you scaled a lot past the, you know, 8 and 16 space if we're already up in the 60s. So you can see they're moving quickly. Obviously, they're making these things stable. That's fascinating that by 2023, they're expecting a commercial device with 1,000 plus qubits in it. That's pretty cool.
That's
coming. It certainly opens up some cans of worms.
Yeah, that is. It is the end of 2020 currently, so we're pretty close.
I think that's right around the corner.
Yeah, we definitely have to start getting ready for this. It actually shows. They say in 2023 we will debut a 1,121 qubit IBM. So they're rounding
very
down
specific.
Actually with the 1,000 number, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
A little more quickly. Qubit packing scales in those systems. You know, is it something like, you know, memory blocks, right? I mean, 32, 64, 128 sort of scaling, or is it different? you have to add two at a time, that sort of stuff. I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Near term, we have ransomware on the, and maybe getting prosecuted if you just pay the ransom. So that's getting interesting. U.S. Department of Treasury.
Whoa. Let's double click on that.
So Bleeping Computer, October 1st, saying U.S. government warning of sanction risk for facilitating ransomware payments. So that gets tricky because you have insurance companies and others right now protecting, you know, schools and so forth, and hospitals. So I think that space is kind of coming to a head there too, how to handle it. It's tricky.
Yeah, that is. That's very interesting. And I haven't read this yet, but so the way that law is being written, they're saying that if you pay the ransom, you may be at risk of having, well, broken the law. So that's just paying into a system. It's kind of like negotiating with terrorists.
Yeah, I'm not fully up on it yet. It looks like the story's still unfolding. I've actually heard about it on This Week in Tech. They've been discussing as well. So it looks like it might be threats for now. But if that's the way we're headed, that could be that could definitely change things for.
I guess I get it. I mean, they're probably thinking to themselves, if no one pays, then bad actors will stop doing it.
Exactly.
You know, maybe that's true if they find another avenue to make money. I just feel like they're going to do a couple of these scenarios where it's like, well, cool, we'll just do it anyways, and then we just won't ever unlock your data. And let's see how strong your laws hold up then.
Yeah, let's see how that works, especially if it's a tied to government, right? Interesting. So there's a quote here kind of at the top of this article, and it just outright sort of establishes what the position is. Is companies that facilitate ransomware payments to cyber actors on behalf of victims, including financial institutions, cyber insurance firms, and companies involved in digital forensics and incident response, not only encourage future ransomware payment demands, but also may risk violating OFAC regulations. Wow. So that is straight up, don't facilitate those payments in a mitigation effort, or you may be running afoul of these regulations. That's very interesting. That is going to bring, I think, a lot of probably ugly news to a head, because ransomwares are, or attacks, which are made public, I feel, almost daily at this point. They're everywhere. Like, a lot of prominent corporations are having these issues. If I would be shocked to find that at a good percentage of them didn't just fork over some amount of payment so that they could get to decrypting and moving on, that this would be a huge issue for daily operations in a lot of those companies if they couldn't get past the breach status. That's interesting.
Well, maybe this is just another thing that gets people to focus better on security and user education. I don't know. Maybe. It's like if they're not, basically what that says is there will be no recourse to get your data back if it happens. So you're basically, in a way, you're being punished for poor security practices. And then what I view as the real personal problem is, you know, not educating your users on the appropriate behavior, which is oftentimes user behavior is usually what leads to ransomware attacks, right? Like the lack of understanding what to do and what not to do. And look, no one's perfect, because like my company tests us on this regularly, and I actually find it kind of fun. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to catch this attack here this time. And I'm going to flag this email or whatever. And then I'll get like three emails from our security team that says, quit flagging appropriate emails. And so I'm overly cautious on it. And then at the same time, have accidentally clicked on one where they're like, you need to take security training now. So it's hard to get all of it down. But we need to be making the effort. And I know a lot of businesses aren't, you know, and that's something to be watching out for is make sure you're not only taking the right, you know, technology and procedural security measures, but also work on education of the workforce. It's just incredibly critical to this entire thing.
That's interesting too, because I know this has come up in my circles in conversations that we have. Naturally, as a VMware employee, I work with corporations that are always trying to protect against this stuff. And now with our security portfolio, of course, we're a lot more involved in those conversations as well. Whether it's mitigation, prevention, all of the sort of pieces, but what's curious as I talk to peers kind of across the globe is that in a few situations, if not often, the breach itself has sort of multiple potential financial impacts, right? You've got inability to conduct business. Obviously, you can take some percentage of revenue. You probably back that out, and you can see that that one hurts a lot. So if you're down, you're usually in a bad place. You've got the data, right? Whatever may have been exfiltrated, for instance, could be loss of IP. It could just be future threats are more likely to happen as a result. And then you've got potential loss of data, right? So if it was encrypted and you couldn't recover it, or you couldn't recover it in a timely manner, then you may also lose dollars and cents on that sort of stuff. But one of the other ones is just reputation, right? So let's say you have public facing data, your systems were breached, it comes out in the news, it somehow made public, you make it public, and that has an impact to just, you know, say stock price, right? What's been interesting to me, though, is that a lot of those companies that come out with these very public, like, we got breached and it's ugly, you know, X hundred thousand users, right? Millions of users, those sorts of things. There isn't always a profound public reputation-based financial impact here. And if you can't add all of those things up, or if you don't, or if you can get around back into transacting quickly and maybe you've got a good backup, then paying a ransom for a few things might be cheaper than actually securing your systems.
That's definitely something that people consider. And
yeah.
You know, of course, I guess it is relative because you don't always know what the bad actors are going to be charging.
Right. Yes, that's true. And sometimes I remember the stories early on. I wonder if anybody knows, it'd be kind of interesting to hear about this. But early on, I remember ransomware actors were just infecting computers, and whatever they got into, whatever system they got into, they'd take a quick look at it. They'd make a phone call, get somebody on the phone and look for a credit card that could get swiped, right? But they were indiscriminate, whether it was your grandma and her laptop or like your local super hospital. And they had no idea what they had on the end of the hook, right? So sure. they could have a whale, but they'd be asking for, you know, $1,000. And I have a feeling they're a little more sophisticated now. They're probably aware when they know that you've got, you know, a gajillion systems as opposed to a single laptop or something along those lines.
I would imagine so at this point.
I imagine there were some pretty big misses early on, which is good, but funny.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
So yeah. Is there anything else we explicitly want to cover before we got to get running?
I feel like Paul's got to give us a quick update on EV.
We may have to have Paul back on.
Yeah. Paul, tell us what's up with Tesla, man.
Sure. Yeah. Even in the last week alone, there's been a bunch of news. One is just some little refreshes to the Model 3, which came out in 2017, small volumes, 2018, by the end of 2018, a little larger volumes. And then finally, there's now, I think, over 500,000 of them on the road. So that's mass production, right? Tesla's trying to ramp up to 500 million vehicles a year and beyond. They're building a factory in Germany called Gigafactory Berlin. Another one, in China, adding to the facility there to make Model Ys in China as well. And then finally, Texas. So that's kind of the big news that's going on for the last month or two. In the last week, the product refresh would be, you've got people watching Tesla's every move. Even the Model 3, they continue to try to crank up efficiency. Awesome. Even taking 19-inch wheels and slightly smoothing them for an extra 1% boost. So now you can list on your EPA ratings, potentially, you know, the cheapest thing you can do is change the shape of the aluminum on a 19-inch wheel. So those little things just definitely appeals to nerds, right? They just keep pushing, even though they're quite ahead technically in many ways, especially in efficiency, you know, the most efficient vehicle. So yeah, that's kind of exciting stuff. And then you got Elon saying some stuff on Twitter that kind of hurts it all. So, you know, you got the PR pluses and minuses. So the personal feeling. But let me just finish with this thought. If you're shopping for a car, I would encourage you to test drive for sure, no matter what. And if it's like a Chevy Bolt where they're begrudgingly making it and you can't even get them in, they're suspending a lot of the vehicles where companies like GM and others made compliance vehicles. So what does that tell you about the company's seriousness about moving that direction? Do you really want to invest in them because Elon said something that pissed you off in a weekend? Yeah, I don't know. It's tough, right? So just think about that. Like every humans have flaws. They absolutely do. And I'm not excusing or an apologist. But the technology is what's exciting. Like you said in your previous podcast.
Give me your hot take on this, both of you. So scale from 1 to 10, how exciting is the news that Alphabet's fully automated driving or self-driving vehicle unit by means of Waymo is releasing 2 years ahead of schedule fully automated taxis in a chunk of Phoenix? Roscoe.
I feel like I am much more on the lines of I would be comfortable with it baking for an additional 2 years as opposed to releasing early. I don't care how confident they are. So that's my initial reaction to that.
How about you, Paul?
Yeah, they have a discrete area in Phoenix. So they can map it. So their confidence is high. So I'm, you know, kind of cool with that. But is that scalable is the question. And Tesla's taking a completely different approach. Only time will tell how that plays out.
Well, I, for one, hope they're both successful, but I did think that was interesting news. Russ, I'm with you. I wonder how much of this is just we got to get out there and get some big public wins, but hopefully it's not moving too fast and causes them to delay in the long run.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, Paul, thanks for the perspective. Thanks for joining us today. This has been awesome, as always, and we're going to let you back to your Monday, but that's it, folks. That brings another Tech Breakfast podcast to a close. It's been fun. We hope you enjoyed it. If you got any news that we missed, let us know. If you'd like to join us on the show, please do. We love having guests on the show. And we will see you guys tomorrow, actually. We're doing a little bit of out of sorts this week while Aaron's out of town. So we're going to have another episode on Tuesday and then again on Wednesday. Peace, everybody. Have a good one.
Later.